Everyone struggles with self-doubt and motivation in their careers, especially us artists. That's why we started the Other 22 Hours podcast. I'm Aaron Schaefer-Hase. I'm a music producer and writer, and I've spent years on the road with tons of different bands.
And I'm Michaela Ann, a singer-songwriter who's put out half a dozen records both independently and with labels and toured all over the world. So we've lived these challenges and conversations ourselves.
Each episode is an artist-to-artist conversation with different musicians, be it Grammy winners like Mary Chapin Carpenter or the Milk Carton Kids, bands like Lucius or Maddie Diaz, songwriters like Lori McKenna, or even legacy artists like Rodney Crowell and Alice Gerard. Each one of them share the tools and routines they've found to stay sane, creative, and inspired while their livelihood is based on their art.
So whether you're an artist yourself or anyone with a passion for creative endeavors, these chats will leave you feeling more inspired, connected, and confident in your own creative journey.
The Other 22 Hours is available wherever you're listening to this podcast, and it's on YouTube. So go find your favorite episode today.
And welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. It's me, Cindy, and I host this podcast. Thank you for finding us today. I am so excited to have Brad Barr on the pod. The Barr Brothers are one of my favorite bands. I have been waiting a long time for a new record, and here we freaking are. Okay, we'll get to that momentarily, but first, I would like to encourage you to sign up for Basic Folk's newsletter. You can do that at the link in the show notes or sign up at basicfolk.com. It's a once-a-month email that lets you know what's going on with the podcast, like who's been on, who's coming up recently, and like pictures of our dogs and everything like that. So you can sign up at the link in the show notes or basicfolk.com. You can also follow us on social media. There's links in the show notes to that at Basic Folk Pod on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok. We're also listener supported. You can make a contribution right now at basicfolk.com/donate. And there's also a link in the show notes to make your donation. Thanks. Okay, let's get to it. In the 8 years since the Barr Brothers last released an album, Andrew has been drumming with people like Feist, Mumford & Sons, and Broken Social Scene, while Brad released a solo record and underwent incredible personal change. Brad made the huge decision to get sober, which he talks about candidly on our interview. Anything that you read about their new record, Let It Hiss, might allude to his newfound sobriety, but not mention it directly. The band made a conscious decision not to include it in any press releases specifically so that their audience could have their own relationship with the new music. And it seems like getting sober has impacted every aspect of the album, but one could listen and project just about any personal pivotal shift onto these songs. Regardless, I am so appreciative that Brad opened up about his sobriety and we could better understand the music and the incredible relationship that he and Andrew share. In our conversation, we talk about Brad's deep connection to the number 216, its origin, and why he's kept that number close to him for most of his life. He shares his reflection on the music lessons given to him and Andrew from visiting Malayan musicians who exchanged their services for free dental work from their father. Those lessons completely changed the musical trajectory of the brothers and still impact them today. We also talk about their former band, who actually are still active every now and again, The Slip, a much-loved Boston group that was fully embraced in the jam band world. I find the music of Andrew and Brad Barr to be completely transformative and not of this world, and I'm so grateful for the new record. Please go see them live, especially if you are into celestial experiences. Let's take a listen to a song from the new album, Let It Hiss. This is Run Right Into It, and then we'll get to our conversation with Brad Barr of the Barr Brothers on Basic Folk.
I'm
Brad, welcome to Basic Folk. So great to talk to you again.
Thanks. Great to see you. Thanks for having me.
So the last time we spoke was in 2017, and we had a wonderful time at WIP in Pittsburgh. And
You
guys just put on an incredible show. I'm so thrilled that the Barr Brothers are back with new music. Just to let you know what you're dealing with here. Big fan.
That means a lot. Thank you, Cindy. Yeah, I'm glad to be back. Where was that show in Pittsburgh? Will you remind me?
The Rex Theater on the South Side.
Oh, yeah. Awesome place. Good popcorn.
Oh, they had popcorn at the Rex Theater.
Hmm.
I know that they had like a really strange backstage area.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's just like the norm for those types of venues where like everything is like black foam everywhere.
Kind of classic vaudeville, right?
Like, yeah.
Yeah. I love those theaters. I mean, they're kind of endangered these days. I feel like if you have one, like protect it in your city.
Totally. So you're big into numbers that I can tell, particularly with the number 216, which has shown up for you over and over again.
Yeah.
I know this isn't like a top of mind thing right now with 216, but like, what's your current status with that number? Like, where does it show up and what are your feelings? What are your 216 feelings like today?
Oh, well, thanks for asking that question. I almost never get asked that. Yeah. First of all, the number shows up for me. It started with a group of friends when we were about 15 or 16. And it's when we first, I think it was my first experience with psychedelics, actually. And that number just arrived. And we all kind of rallied around it and it started showing up in our life. And I don't do psychedelics anymore, but I appreciated them and what they did at the time. So these days it seems to show up when I am in motion, when I'm out there. The number for me represents that friendship first and foremost. And that group of friends. And
is this the same group of friends that are the Queens of the Breakers?
They are the very same friends.
Oh,
yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. It was a really formative time. And I look at it now. I realize how lucky I was to have this core group of friends at that period of my life when I was 14, 15, 16. I still talk with all of them. So that number, firstly is a symbol of that friendship. But it seems to spill into other people's lives when I communicate its significance to me, at least those that sort of listen. And right now it's actually kind of a family bond, that number, because Brigitte, who we'll talk about later, my wife, made up a bunch of t-shirts and baseballs with my name and that number on it as merch items to bring around, but really also as tokens of, I don't know, whatever symbols we sort of can find in our lives. You know, it's just sort of a beautification and adds some kind of mystery to our lives, some interest that sometimes that's all it takes to feel some kind of, a little growing, budding community or just rallying around mysticism. You know, I think there's not enough of that in our culture. So because that number does have a lot of mystic qualities to it that other cultures also recognized. And it's on the baseball because the baseball has 216 stitches.
Right on.
So I wish I had one sitting by that I could show you. But for me today, 216, it's it connects us. So that's a good start.
Yeah, great start. I love the idea of rallying around mysticism. I've been trying to conjure that up recently.
Yeah. To it. Yeah. I mean, music concerts are maybe one of the, one of the last sort of places where that happens on Earth.
Mm-hmm. I feel like when I saw your band last, like your band completely omits mysticism from start to beginning. Like I felt like my friend and I were texting. I was like, I'm going to talk to the Barr Brothers tomorrow. Do you remember that concert? He was like, one of the best concerts I've been to. It just feels like you guys are radiating that type of connectivity. It's great.
So happy to hear that.
Run, don't walk to the Barr Brothers show.
That is, what I see as part of my role here to help create, nurture, sustain that kind of awe. Because I think in that kind of awe state, and not the kind of awe that you get from, you know, watching a virtuoso or anything. It's not about virtuosity or impressing people. It's about like opening people up and with sound. And so you feel that sense of wonder. And I think we've become really more compassionate, empathetic, and joyful when that happens.
You and your brother grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, and you had a pretty special experience growing up where your dad, who is a dentist, did some dental work on some musicians from Mali in exchange for music lessons for his son, so you and Andrew. And Andrew even went back to Mali to continue the lessons. So it seems like that chance meeting seems to have like completely shaped your outlook on rhythm. How do you relate to those lessons now, nearly 35 years on?
It's a great question. So at the time, you know, Andrew, I don't know what, if it hadn't been for that, those encounters and through our dad being a very kind person and wanting to help these guys that just walked into his office one day. When I see these guys, I mean, it started with Issa, who was a djembe master. And when Issa told Mamadou and Abdul about the dentist who fixes teeth for music lessons, pretty soon there was, yeah, like five or six guys. And we got invited to their house to hang out. And, you know, Andrew had always had that rhythmic urge in him. He had always had that, just drawn to it. I don't know whether the circumstance, how much the circumstances led to that. I know they did. I know he also had always gravitated towards rhythmic music. Boy, it's really cool to think about it. Cause yeah, if he hadn't, opened his doors to these guys, I don't know how different our music would be today. It gave us a insight.
You'd be like Jason Mraz-ing all over the place.
Thinking that. He's got pretty good rhythm, but not that syncopated thing. Or maybe he does, and he just doesn't record those songs. Yeah, we suddenly were exposed to a lot of polyrhythmic music and the kind of plasticity of it all. I think mm-hmm. I think was really important at the time to see people taking a simple rhythm, you know, whatever it was, whatever the bass rhythm was, and then passing it around and other people taking it and running with it, doing their own thing. And the laughter that happened when someone did something really cool, or just, you know, like that, seeing music be shaped and misshapen and improvised on the spot was really important. I mean, that's, it kind of set us up for like, if,
yeah,
this is how it's done. You play it and you spin it and you twist it until there's laughter, really, until you just are so amused by it that, you know, and that, I think that's one of the things that's kept us going for so long, is that just sort of impulse to just keep it fresh.
I have like a technical question about this. I'm not a musician and I don't know very much about music theory, but I read about your learning from these Malayan musicians. You said something like they taught you different ways to hear a 6/8 bell line. And I read it in at least two different places. So it like seems important, but it completely went over my head. Can you explain what that means? Like a 6/8 bell line and where we might hear that in the Bar Brothers?
Sure. To the best that I can. Yeah. So they have an instrument there called a gongkogui, and it's like a cowbell with a small one and a big small bell and a big bell. And the rhythm that we're referring to there, it played on the gongkogui, sounds like this. Now, when you take that, just that part alone, there's so much inside of that, depending on where you put the bass. Depending on how, if you put a subdivision of 4/4 beat or a 6/8 beat or three beats over that, there's a lot of ways to bend that rhythm. For example, the clave, what we know as a clave, which is, you know, in Cuban music is a derivation of that rhythm. So it can be, it is kind of the key to unlocking a certain way of grooving where things become really malleable and really flexible. A good example in the Barr Brothers music would be Half Crazy, where you got this dum boo doo 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 boo doo 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 ding ding da ding 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 da ding ding da ding 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 da ding ding da ding ding ding. So it's stretching. Suddenly, the options for how you phrase a thing become just so much wider, and it all was derived from that West African 6/8 bell line. Some people call it the clave. I learned it as the bell line. It was really just the bell line, and sort of that ubiquitous. And it is what gave birth to the way the blues was played early on. That shuffle feel, swing in jazz, swinging wouldn't exist without that fundamental.
Yeah, it's like bending the rigid beat.
Yes,
sounds like the cure for anxiety.
Yeah, it's the DNA to it's the DNA to basically all the groove that we love. What did you say?
It's a cure for anxiety.
I certainly see it that way. And that's a good description of it.
One more question about this experience. So the story of your dad exchanging dental work for lessons, I think it's like really amazing, especially in thinking how generous everyone was in that situation. When you think back about that experience, what did it teach you about being generous with your talents?
Well, my dad, he's always shown me two things. One is do what you love. And two is be kind, help people out whenever possible. If he sees someone's car is on the side of the road, he'll be the first to pull over and see if they need help. He's really, he becomes very gregarious when there's someone in need of something. And that, this was all really subconscious stuff because my dad didn't read a ton of books. He didn't like exercise or build a house. You know, there wasn't this like stereotypical dad information coming to me in that way, and like the usual we think of a father offering their son, you know, advice or stuff. Didn't have a lot of advice. But through watching him do what he did, which was help people with their teeth, which when you have a toothache, it's the dentist is like a saint, you know, it's the joy that comes from being relieved of a toothache. I saw that repeatedly and watching, over the years, just this, how subconsciously I think it affected me was watching a person do what they love and see how it brings joy to other people and how those other people then want to give back. And, he did it with art work as well. A lot of painters, friends of mine that were going to the Rhode Island School of Design, because his office was located pretty much right on that campus, he would offer to trade dental work for pieces of art that they couldn't pay for the work, that they couldn't afford what the work cost to trade artwork. And they were just so happy to give paintings to him, and they'd even give paintings to us as well. So yeah, just learning that what comes around goes around, really. Like that's it sounds cliche, but it's still really true.
Yeah. Are known for also being in the much loved band The Slip back when you were famously my neighbor in Mission Hill in Boston. When you began, The Slip was firmly entrenched in the jam band scene. And I myself have dabbled in the jam band world. The jam band world is a very special place. Lots of music festivals, lots of flip-flops and cargo shorts, lots of very devoted and unusually friendly fans. How do you think your work in the slip and the jam band world has impacted your musical approach to the Barr Brothers or the way that you engage with your audience?
So that's another great question, because I guess my first thought is to kind of compare it to maybe the way other bands engage with their audience. I'm not sure. Like, I want to think about that, because it's really about an audience band dynamic. Because the jam band, where I could comment on that in any number of ways, and how it influenced us at the time, and how that influence is carried into the Barr Brothers. On that note, I would sort of signal back to even just that, the experiences with the West African guys and the idea of improvisation, because that was a big part of the jam world. Separate from the jazz world, which also has a lot of improvisation, I think it was also the spirit of like people being able to move, because that was one of the things about going to jazz concerts that I at the time didn't necessarily love, was that I had to sit in a chair, and I liked the freedom that people felt at these sort of jam band concerts. And I didn't, you know, I saw Fish a bunch, and I saw Medeski, Martin, and Wood a bunch. And the Slip played a lot of jam band festivals. Like, I think I just liked seeing people feel liberated to move. You know, that was the thing about the 60s music that really resonated with me, was just the sense of freedom. And, you know, in some kind of communing with the audience, those shows always feel better to me when I, and as they do to anybody, I guess there's not really a musician out there who doesn't feel better when they commune with the audience, and whatever communing means. But I like playing in venues where people are on their feet, people are moving, there's like this closeness.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting, because a lot of the Barr Brothers shows happen in seated venues, which I think was just by virtue of the fact that the music was chiller. The music was more less danceable in the beginning, but not maybe so much with the last record. The one that hasn't come out yet.
The current record
is I actually feel like it's probably way closer to what the Slip was shooting for than anything the Barr Brothers has done before. And just because we really weren't trying to curate anything. We didn't have any, it was part of the length of the, how much time went by. I think we did a lot of just letting go of this need to curate a Barr Brothers experience, which I think maybe it's hard to speak to where my head was at the time, but I think we were trying to differentiate the Barr Brothers from the Slip. Like, that was important to us. And so now I think we're just letting, even with the Slip just played in California. And I think our true musical leanings are really coming out in both projects in a really nice way, in a really refreshing and satisfying way. Such a long answer. I'm sorry.
But no, it's cool to hear you figure it out in real time.
Or not figure it out.
So the last record, Queens of the Breakers, came out in 2017. So 8 years in between albums. And here's what Andrew was up to during that time, playing drums with Feist, Mumford & Sons, Gracie Abrams, Broken Social Scene. You released a solo instrumental album and other creative endeavors. And I know there's been like a lot of emotional growth and change between you two, which, if you're game, I'd want to get to that as well. But when you and Andrew came back together, musically speaking, for Let It Hiss, what was it like to witness each other's evolution and growth musically speaking again in that period?
From our perspective, I think it never really felt like, it didn't feel like we were ever apart. For one, we live together. We own a house together, and we were showing up at the studio together a lot during that time. There was, the pandemic hit. Our Queens of the Breakers was released, did you say 2017?
Yep.
We spent about 2 years touring that, and then in 2020 the pandemic hit and everything kind of shut down. I think for the first time since we were 18, we were like didn't feel the pressure. It was suddenly there was nobody saying, well, you know, well, we weren't saying to ourselves, we got to get out there and tour, got to make a record, got to get in the cycle again. Suddenly we just took a step back and it was a real relief. Not that we'd grown tired of music. It was just kind of a relief to not have the pressure on ourselves. I was writing songs, but they hadn't really amounted to much in my esteem. They were just these fragments. We both had young children, and we were also taking projects that were more studio centric. Like we worked for a Montreal company called The Moment Factory, doing these sort of immersive light experiences where we weren't even necessarily credited. We were just like honing these studio skills, building these soundscapes, sound design stuff. We got pretty immersed in that to the point where with no tour prospects, my songwriting process slowed down a lot. I think I do write with the stage in mind, and that just wasn't there. So the songwriting process slowed. Andrew was taking the gigs with at the time Feist. He was also working on a bunch of other stuff with Aaron Dessner. I was just kind of like, I guess at the time I felt like I was fumbling around with these songs that I couldn't bring to the finish line. And one thing for me that happened was I decided to get sober, which I didn't even necessarily realize how much a weight that was for me. I didn't realize what was on the other side of that for me creatively. It just is hard to see when alcohol and drugs are like part of one's life. So
isn't that crazy?
Yeah. I didn't.
How numb you are. And then you get off the stuff and you're like, I can feel everything.
Yeah. It was wild. It still is wild. And like, I just made that decision to do that because I knew something needed to change. I knew that if we were going to have a really fruitful next phase of our musical lives together, something dramatic had to change. And that was the one thing I could focus on.
Yeah.
So remove that from my life. That was, you know, harder than I thought and more rewarding than I thought. And when I sort of started finding my footing in sobriety is when this record suddenly just poured out.
Okay.
It was like this. And my relationship with Andrew
went
from like just being locked in this thing from the past, locked in these patterns of relating to each other and working together. It all just became dislodged. All of the patterns of regarding myself, how I identified, how I regarded Andrew, my family, music, my role as a musician, it all just shook loose from this like locked, you know, mud.
Okay, so it seems like in reading like the press release about this record, it seems like there was a something that happened that completely changed everything. Was your getting sober the thing that happened?
I would say yes.
Okay. I have like five questions about like, what is this document of transformation?
Oh, yeah.
It's the sobriety.
You know why we didn't put it in the press release is because I didn't want it to color or shape the way people heard this record. In as much as I like people to be able to relate their own experiences. You know, the sobriety journey is one kind of journey to have of transformation, of letting go, of surrender. There's so many other, you know, most people don't identify as, you know, addicts or alcoholics. But most people can identify with some kind of either a need for transformative experience, something they need to let go, something they need to move through. So I really wanted people to be able to hear this record and relate their own experience to the songs, to the message in the song. So I didn't, you know, we talked about whether to put that into the into the press release, but I just we ended up kept coming back to, like, I really want people to have their own experience with these songs and not to feel like they can't relate to it because it's about addiction. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Right on. I was like, I totally respect what you're saying, but I was like, I wish I knew what the thing was so that I could formulate all these really invasive questions about it. But well, that's cool.
I was just saving it to tell you yourself.
Yeah. Great. Bury the headline. Thank you, Brad Barr. My wife and I just watched the Indigo Girls documentary last night, which you should watch it if you haven't seen it. It's on Netflix now, so it's not too hard to... Oh, I don't know if it's in Canada or not, but...
I'd love to watch that.
Yeah, worth it. And there is a part where Emily is, like, very candidly talking about her struggle with alcohol and how, like, listening to her talk about being an alcoholic and... basically, like, how Amy was trying to handle it. And she said, Amy came to me 3 times to talk about it. And it sounded like there was, like, a huge intervention with Amy and Emily's wife and maybe some other people. And she, you know, finally did get sober, but it is you might find it of interest to see, like, from her perspective of, like, a working relationship that sounds, I mean, I don't think Amy and Emily own a house together, but they are pretty tight. But yeah, I was thinking about that while you were talking about how that impacted, how your choice to become sober impacted Andrew. Do you have any idea about his thoughts about it?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't want to speak for him, but I could say that I know how brutal it got towards the end. I know how frustrating it was, probably similar to Amy or anybody that has to live with or work with someone in active addiction. Like the lying, the hiding, the trying to, like, the not knowing if he can rely on me for basic things. Or, like, creating the, you know, helping keep our career and our music going, our spiritual life together going. I mean, that for me, like, was the big one. I didn't know. I could see that, okay, maybe I'm not as productive. I didn't realize what a sort of spiritual succubus.
Ooh, good word.
Alcoholism and addiction was. That's the thing that's very much come back is, for lack of a better word, a spiritual way of regarding the world and my experience here. I mean, music creation and what its fundamental purposes are for us, yeah, as community. And Andrew is, I would say he's thrilled about it.
Great.
Yeah.
While I was thinking about you and Andrew being brothers in this band, another sibling band that came to mind are fellow Canadians, Tegan and Sarah. And they have said in the past that they are sisters first and a band second. Do you feel that way about the Barr brothers?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, when it comes down to it, absolutely. Andrew, like, for example, he can't be here right now because he has a 10-month-old that he's out pushing around in a stroller. But, like, tomorrow he has to fly, or tonight he has to fly to New York, or I think he's going to fly to New York to play with Feist. And I know my role then is I take over for Ischia for his daughter. You know, he knows that he can go work because I can be here as an uncle for the baby. All to say, like, that family, that sense of family is, we get all those discussions out of the way first. how's mom doing? What does she need? Does she, you know, what are dad's, you know, we basically get all the family stuff done first, and then we can tackle the music, or, you know, or let the music tackle us. But we are brothers first. I couldn't necessarily say that before. I didn't know what, not to bring it back to the addiction thing, but
sure,
as an addict or an alcoholic, that comes first. That's the ultimate shittiness of that stuff.
And yeah.
And so, I'm really happy to say that that is also in the press, in the thing we wrote up. I mean, that was really the thing. I feel like we definitely came back together as brothers, and that gave way to all this, you know, what I would say the coolest music we've made. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to just thought of something by not including the fact that you got sober. And the fact that you're not putting it in the press release, do you feel like what are your thoughts about not being able to talk about it like publicly and like process it publicly? Like, is that going to be a problem for you?
No, I'm actually like, this is actually, Cindy, this is the first podcast I've done for the new record. This is This is the first interview.
Right on. Hell yeah.
And I remember at the time when we were talking about, well, do we put that in the sort of headlines of the press release? It was like, well, I don't think we have to put it in there because we don't need to, like, we don't want every single article written about this record to be about that. But when
Brad Barr no longer going to the bar.
I know. There's just too many little plays on words and
journalism.
Yeah, that's tough. But no, I don't feel actually any like shame or hesitation or reluctance. I love talking about it. And if it gets a conversation going with anyone, someone who has a relative or a friend who's struggling, or someone directly, you know, like, it's one of my favorite topics. So it was all kind of agreed, like, okay, we won't mention it in the press, but any time the conversation goes there, like, I feel particularly comfortable here, and you're easy to talk about this stuff with. So I said, well, I'll just open up when it feels right. And in fact, it's the very first podcast and first interview. I have a feeling I'll probably talk about it a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's because we're old neighbors.
I guess that's it. What was it? We were on Allegheny. What were you? Allegheny Street on Mission Hill. What was your street?
Parker Hill Avenue.
Parker Hill.
Right at the tip top.
Yeah. That was the perpendicular to Allegheny, right? Like, you would have got, if you kept going on yours, you would have ended up in...
Yep, it loops around. Yeah. You're over by the orange line.
Yeah, Roxbury Crossing stop. Wait, did we hang...
In the cool part of Mission Hill.
Well, we did live next to Eric Krasno and the Lettuce House.
Oh.
They were our neighbors. And did we ever hang out? Did you go to the...
No, like, I was like a little kid I was in college still.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah, I guess college ended for me in 96, but I...
I'm a few years younger than you, so it was definitely like, whoa.
Who are these? Who are these bohemian...
Too cool. Right?
Oh, yeah. If only you knew, actually.
Right.
Yeah, that was a very fun, cool, productive time, and also sort of the end of the slip too. In that period there, not the end of the slip. The slip still happens, but the end of that phase.
The end of the Boston residence.
Yeah,
of the slip.
I digress.
To ask you about the female voice in your music. I think it's like pretty unique the way you use female vocals. In particular, I'm thinking about Lucius opening up Queens of the Breakers on your last record. Jossie Adams of Arc Iris, her voice is on Let It Hiss. Land of Talk on Let It Hiss. Mm-hmm. It's just, there's like a cool effect that they're bringing to the table that seems to be like the same kind of aesthetic. So I don't know if you have ever thought about this, but like what kind of intentionality and function do you see the female voice playing in your songs?
Wow. I've never really thought about it in terms of like, if there was a concept. I really just thought this song would be much better if it had Elizabeth Powell on it. It would sound much better if Jossie Adams or Ariel Engel was in there helping it out.
It is like, it just seems like to bring it back to like mystical or heavenly, like not to confuse this with like the female mystique and the male gaze and all that bullshit or something like that. But like something like spiritual is happening when you hear a female voice on the Barr Brothers songs.
I really think that is just, I don't even think, I know that that is just by virtue of those women who sang there. I gave very little direction. I gave Jossie, for example, on English Harbor, we sent her the song. I was hoping to get back a single vocal line, something, just a little harmony line. Something like this. She sent back 20 tracks of like,
I believe it.
High concept. Still whimsical, still like very, there's nothing stiff, whimsical, but totally imaginative and mystifying vocals that, I think we just have a good instinct on
who to ask.
Yeah. Like Elizabeth Powell on Run Right Into It. Her voice just has this quality. She and I lock really well together when we're singing these sort of duets, the way our voices resonate. But Elizabeth, they bring this incredible focus that we just wanted them on that record. And Lucius, actually very much same thing as Jossie. We sent them the song, said we're looking for some backup vocals, and they came back with this extremely generous. So I just think we ask the right people, and maybe there is something about the way we approach music, the intention that's, you know, to kind of some kind of openness that they feel like, okay, well then I'm not just going to send them back some sort of phoned in vocal harmony. I'm going to like send in something that takes that further.
Yeah. I also wanted to know, like, historically, what's been your relationship to female singers and how they've impacted you?
I definitely come from a pretty like male-dominated world, whether it's the jazz world, the jam world, rock and roll. These are all like really, I mean, you know, at least historically, these very sort of male-dominated areas of music. I don't know. You could talk for a whole podcast about why that is, but so it's been incredibly refreshing anytime a woman brings that energy into what it is we're doing. Just as a relief, you know. I can personally get very like, dude-minded about music, trying to control this thing, using this very cerebral approach to it. Mm-hmm. And I think that what women have always unlocked for us is that like melting side. That's part of us that just, for me, where I stop trying to like manipulate and control, because
right.
I'm so limited with my like need to control things that when all the women that we've worked with, it's just unlocked the emotion, like just gone deeper down towards the sort of root center. I'm so grateful for the women that have shared that with me, like going back to even our friend Leslie Helpert, in Boston who lived at the Allegheny House with us, was one of
them. That's when I first met Andrew, when Leslie came into WERS.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You remember Leslie? I'm so glad to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Leslie was one of the first women to, I mean, she literally like put her hands on my belly and was like, I need to shake something out of you. Like,
yeah,
you
know? she was very like kumbaya, earthy.
Yeah, she could just flow. She, you know, she would write every year. She'd fill up a book, a huge, like thick writing book with drawings, poems, just full, like one of these most amazing. I was like, this could be an ancient tome. This has all this. And then she would burn it at the end of the year. She would just burn these. I was like,
listeners, Brad is holding his hands to his face. Yeah. In shock.
If I wrote 10 pages of what she put on these things, it would be like, it'd be in the news or it'd be like on my wall or something. She would, it's just this letting, this release. I don't know. I've just had a great luck, great, you know, very fortunate to meet and interact and create with women that, you know, not often enough, really, if you ask me, but just often enough that I feel like, extremely like I've walked away from every experience with a deeper understanding of really why we do this.
All right, next Brad Barr solo record, collaborations with all women.
That's what I'm thinking. And one guy named Brad. Oh yeah, my friend Isaac Taylor also has that. I was thinking of men in my life who also have that thing. My friend Isaac
will allow it.
Okay, this is one exception.
Isaac is an approved man.
Yes.
Lizzie, who co-hosts this podcast with me, we always talk about Basic Folk's approved men.
Okay.
And there's like two men on the list. It's Mark Arelli and Lizzie's dog, Berlin.
Okay. It's pretty.
And maybe Brad Barr.
Oh, I, you know, give me a little time.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't want to make my application just yet.
Let's make that solo record with all women.
You produce it.
Great.
Okay.
I've always wanted to. Great. This sounds good. So the last time that you and I spoke, we did an interview at WIP in 2017, and I searched high and low to try to find this interview online or in my archives, and I don't have it. So it just lives in my heart at this point. But we talked about how you not struggled, but you were just kind of like not super into the quote unquote pretty songs you were writing. Not to bash the pretty songs because we love them, but it seems to me that the pretty songs are on Let It Hiss, but they have evolved and they have morphed with this like psych improv experimental sound that you're also very good at. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, if you agree with me, and then what do you attribute that coalescence?
Well, sounds like I was typically full of shit back then. It's like I didn't know who would say a thing like I'm not into the pretty songs. I don't know.
That's not a direct quote, but okay.
something along those lines. I mean,
something along those lines. Well, like it seemed to me that you were like, I want to make fuzzy guitar noise rock songs, but you had all these like beautiful, delicate melodies that were coming out of you. And you were like, I got to get these out of here. But then what I really want to do is play these like dirty, you know, big psych rock songs.
Which is kind of what Let It Hiss has become. It's this like these beautiful songs, these kind of songs that were written in a, with that aesthetic, but blown up.
That's right.
Well, you know, I think at that time, I don't know how to say this without, my reaction to playing with, the harp in the band, which probably we were talking in, you said like 2017.
Mm-hmm.
By that point I'd been playing with Sarah Page, for about eight years. Sarah Page was our harp player in the Barr Brothers for a while. And, I loved it every time. I loved playing with Sarah. It was like, it opened my musical world like in ways I can't even express. But I'm guessing that by 2017, it's playing in a band with a harp player, there's so much restraint that we had to exhibit every show and in recording. It kept us, and it was one of the things that actually, that it was one of the things that was a virtue. It is a virtue for us who will just, you know, volume and self-indulgent guitar solos and just not kind of having a ceiling. It was really good for us to have a ceiling, and the harp played a role in that ceiling. And I think probably by 2017, I was like banging on the ceiling a little bit, like wanting to, you know, maybe feeling like writing for the harp had become always writing music where I was like, and I have to consider the harp, how the harp's going to do this. Started to feel a little constricting. I don't mean this in any way, like it's nothing against Sarah or any harpist. I think I just, my relationship to writing for the harp had maybe started to hit a wall. And we've since had Sarah left the band in 2017 and has been pursuing studies in Japanese music really effectively and successfully, with like a degree. Evelyn Gregoire Rousseau came on as a harp player, and we really couldn't believe we had a second harp player who was willing to get on the road with a rock and roll band and plug her harp into fuzz pedals. So creative and such a good spirit and such a great player. I think I was still feeling like Andrew and I needed to get back to some basics. It felt like kind of going out without a net when this past year we've done a bunch of duo shows, found ways to get the low end and the bass in there. But we came to rely so much on the harp for its optics as this instrument that nobody's ever seen before. I think we really relied on everything that the harp brought, sonically, in terms of optics, in terms of having a female presence on the stage. I think we were just leaning on it all a little bit heavily and needed to know what it was like to do it without the harp for a minute. Know what the Barr Brothers was without a harp.
Right.
Was it? Was the Barr Brothers a band without a harp? So yeah, I'm guessing by my answer at that time, I was probably thinking about some of this stuff.
Right on. The cover art was done by your wife, Brigitte Henry, who does a lot of the Barr Brothers and also your solo work, the visuals for your music. So how does her aesthetic match that of the Barr Brothers, and how do you and she communicate about what the visuals should be?
She just tells me what it should be, and I just agree. No, it's actually this one was quite a process, you know, and usually Andrew and I agree on a lot, but like how the band should be visually represented, we don't always agree. And this record, he really wanted it to have, his whole thing was, I want it to be a really fun cover, almost like a comic, you know, or like not like I think he was picturing like Terry Gilliam, like cut at Monty Python cutout, like,
oh cool,
you know, something like that. Bridget brings this depth. I mean, you talk about like the mystery, she can find it in anything. She just if there's light and if there's a light and a shadow, she can bring all the, you know, illuminate it and articulate it and bring it all out. On this record, Andrew, I think, felt like I really want to get away from that. Like, I want it to be really different. All our other records have had this kind of mysterious quality that Bridget brings, really just through, I mean, it's just through the way she sees light and shadows. It's inherently mystifying. So for this one, she knew what Andrew wanted it to be, brighter or more, I don't know, spontaneous or something. The process she took to get to the record cover was so unique and so crazy. We're going to make a making of the album cover just because what you see on the cover there was this such a strange journey and so cool. She's in the next room right now, and I hope she's hearing it because because I could never, none of us could have ever predicted what came out. Well, I don't know if I need to go into the process because that really wasn't the question, but how she influences, I just trust her implicitly. I know that what she's going to come up with is going to see something that I couldn't see. It's going to have her own take, and her name is Bridget Henry, for those of you listening, Bridgette Henry. And she's made a lot of album covers, including album covers for Patrick Watson. A bunch of Montreal artists, Esmarine, Becky Foon. And she works in animation also as an art director. So she creates these miniature sets. So her whole, she just has a way of looking at it that I could never dream up. I could never say, like, I want this to happen and it would happen. She just tries things.
That's so cool.
Yeah, I'm very lucky to have someone as creative as her, you know, in the next room and seeing things the way she sees them.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
When you're talking about how Andrew wanted a more cartoon album cover, the thing that came to mind, and this is not going to translate for the podcast listeners, is the Brandy Carlile Elton John album cover.
Okay. Do you have it there?
You're going to be, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's probably what Let It Hiss would look like if Andrew was the art director.
So I want you to show Brigitte, Who Believes in Angels by Brandy Carlile and Elton John.
Okay.
For your next Brad Barr solo album.
I think she would probably have a heart attack. That record cover, I don't think would do it for her. Love Brandy Carlile and Elton John, the two of them.
Listen, if you haven't seen it, it looks like a game show promo for like a midday game show promo.
I love it. Oh, there she is. Hey, Bridget. There she is. Hey, Bridget. No, she said no.
No, okay.
I love that album. Can you hold it up one more time?
Oh, wait, I just closed.
You just closed the... Sorry, I'll find it myself.
All right,
it looks, that looks like what Andrew was going for. And to be honest,
because I was like, when you said Monty Python, I was like, oh, no, that's not it. But then I looked at it again. I was like, ah, okay, all right, little bit.
Yeah, like... just kind of, I mean, it was, you know, that or like early skateboard art, I think, was one of these sort of influences. We were both skaters when we were young, and I still do skate, but I just think you wanted something kind of irreverent, and Bridget's artwork always carries this kind of, like, there's something deeper going on. And
like Edward Gorey.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of whimsical, but also what is going on here?
Yeah. I wish I had
maybe less murder for Brigitte.
Yeah.
Less murder.
Go have a look at her website with like her other artwork on there. She also, I mean, she started in photography. So her first production output as an artist was a book of photography where she took huge prints of scenery, scenic back, like a tornado hitting a building, submerged them in water and then dropped a human being in front of that. So the person was like in mid, you know, water, submerged in water, floating, suspended in front of a huge background scene of something incongruous, like a cathedral with this floating human. So, yeah.
Wow. So creative. Well, before I let you go, will you do the lightning round?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. What is your favorite town in Rhode Island?
Providence.
What is your not even like a
Westerly,
Pawtucket, or
it's got to be Providence.
What is your next dream life? Like, what is your dream next life? Human, animal, bird, etc.
Oh, my next life as a hollow body Gibson, yes, 175.
So first a tree,
yeah,
and then a hollow body Gibson. Mm-hmm. Okay, awesome. Who is your celebrity crush?
Vince Vaughn.
Which musician, living or dead, would you want to ride a tandem bike with?
John Cage.
This is the last one. Where is the most beautiful place in the world?
Martha's Vineyard.
Great. Brad Barr, thank you so much. This was awesome. So great to catch up.
Thanks, Cindy. Let's do it again. Maybe not in 8 years. Let's do it again in like a couple years. Yeah? Okay.
Okay, that sounds good.
Great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Basic Folk is a production of BGS. You can find all of our episodes there. You can check us out wherever you get podcasts. You can look us up on FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. Search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. Or you can check out our website, BasicFolk.com. If you enjoyed this episode, perhaps you should share it with your friend Steve, who you saw the Barr Brothers with in 2017, or was it 2018? But anyways, you had a great time and you can't stop talking about it, and you text each other about it every now and again. Send this episode to Steve. Okay, thanks for listening all the way to the end. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.